From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We are coming to you live from Boston's Fleet Center tonight, the site of the Democratic National Convention, where this evening Democrats are beginning to make their formal convention case for the White House. In just a few moments, former Vice President and year 2000 contender Al Gore will speak to the hall. We will bring you that in live reports from the convention floor. But the real business kicking off tonight is a tough fight for the presidency. And we're going to take a hard look tonight at what the Kerry Edwards ticket stands for in this election, beyond beating George W. Bush, at the vision that drives John Kerry on the issues, the economy, social policy, foreign policy. This hour on Point, live from the Democratic National Convention, John Kerry on the issues, beyond Bush, where he would take the nation. You can join our conversation tonight. How do you read the heart of a potential Kerry presidency on the issues that matter to you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. On the floor right now, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson is introducing Al Gore, who will come on in just a moment. Let's listen to a bit of that introduction.
Years before anyone else, and who is a fighter for all those who felt that they never had anyone in their corner. No one to give their dreams a voice, and who is respected throughout the world over as a statesman, as a diplomat, and as a fervent defender of America's interests and values. The last time this man stood before our convention, our party embraced him, and he in turn embraced Tipper. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor to introduce you to a good friend, a colleague, one of this country's greatest leaders and patriots, and the man who on Election Day 2000, more people chose to be the President of the United States, Al Gore!
New Mexico Governor Bill Richards giving a rousing welcome to Al Gore, who's striding onto the podium now to a pretty big reception in this hall with that dig at the 2000 results. Two men embrace Al Gore stepping to the podium. It is the first night of the Democratic National Convention. Still several nights to go before John Kerry makes his appearance, but here is the man who was nominated and did not take the White House after a hotly contested vote in the year 2000. Al Gore's had a low profile for some time after that election, but has moved more steadily back into the limelight. He's looking very familiar tonight, back at sort of his fighting weight of the year 2000, and the hall is on its feet. We're going to be listening to most of Al Gore's speech tonight, probably all of it, and then we'll turn to your calls. Let's listen. Al Gore patting his chest. My heart is beating, he signals to this Democratic crowd. A big smile from the former Vice President.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. My friends, fellow Democrats, fellow Americans, I'm going to be candid with you. I had hoped to be back here this week under different circumstances running for re-election. But you know the old saying, you win some, you lose some, and then there's that little-known third category. But I didn't come here tonight to talk about the past. After all, I don't want you to think that I lie awake at night counting and recounting sheep. I prefer to focus on the future because I know from my own experience that America is a land of opportunity where every little boy and girl has a chance to grow up and win the popular vote.
Al Gore having a lot of fun with his 2000 outcome and the audience responding wholeheartedly.
In all seriousness, I am deeply, deeply grateful for the opportunity you have given me to serve my country. I want to thank you as Democrats for the honor of being your nominee for president 4 years ago. and for all you did for me and for our country. And I want to thank the American people for the privilege of serving as Vice President of the United States. Most of all, I want to thank my family with all my heart, my children and grandchildren, especially my beloved partner in life, Tipper.
Al Gore blowing a kiss to the woman that he famously and deeply kissed at the high podium in the convention of 2000, and the audience is on its feet again.
I love this country deeply. Wasn't B.B. Wynans great? I believe that's the best national anthem I've ever heard sung. I love this country deeply, and even though I always look to the future with optimism and hope, I do think it's worth pausing for just a moment as we begin this year's convention to take note of two very important lessons from 4 years ago. The first lesson is this: take it from me, every vote counts. In our democracy, every vote has power. And never forget that power is yours. Don't let anyone take it away from you or talk you into throwing it away. And let's make sure that this time, every vote is counted. Let's make sure that the Supreme Court does not pick the next president, and that this president is not the one who picks the next Supreme Court. The second lesson from 2000 is this: what happens in a presidential election matters a lot. The outcome profoundly affects the lives of all 293 million Americans and people in the rest of the world, too. The choice of who is president affects your life and your family's future. And never has that been more true than in 2004. Because let's face it, our country faces deep challenges. These challenges we now confront are not Democratic or Republican challenges. They are American challenges that we all must overcome together, as one people, as one nation. And it is in that spirit that I sincerely ask those watching at home tonight who supported President Bush 4 years ago, did you really get what you expected from the candidate you voted for? Is our country more united today or more divided? Has the promise of compassionate conservatism been fulfilled, or do those words now ring hollow? For that matter, are the economic policies really conservative at all? For example, did you expect the largest deficits in history, year after year, one right after another, and the loss of more than a million jobs? By the way, I know about the bad economy. I was the first one laid off. And while it's true that new jobs are being created, they're just not as good as the jobs people have lost. And incidentally, that's been true for me, too. Unfortunately, this is no joke for millions of Americans. And the real solutions require us to transcend partisanship. So that's one reason why, even though we meet here as Democrats, we believe this is a time to reach beyond our party lines to Republicans as well. And I also ask tonight for the consideration and the help of those who supported a third-party candidate in 2000. I urge you to ask yourselves this question: do you still believe that there was no difference between the candidates? Are you troubled by the erosion of America's most basic civil liberties? Are you worried that our environmental laws are being weakened and dismantled to allow vast increases in pollution that are contributing to a global climate crisis? No matter how you voted in the last election, these are profound problems that all voters must take into account this November 2nd. And, of course, no challenge is more critical than the situation we confront in Iraq. Regardless of your opinion at the beginning of this war, isn't it now abundantly obvious that the way this war has been managed by the administration has gotten us into very serious trouble? Wouldn't we be better off with a new president who hasn't burned his bridges to our allies and who can rebuild respect for America in the world? Isn't cooperation with other nations crucial to solving our dilemma in Iraq? Isn't it also critical to defeating the terrorists? We have to be crystal clear about the threat we face from terrorism. It is deadly, it is real, it is imminent. But in order to protect our people, shouldn't we focus on the real source of this threat, the group that attacked us and is trying to attack us again, Al-Qaeda, headed by Osama bin Laden? Wouldn't we be safer with a president who didn't insist on confusing Al-Qaeda with Iraq? Doesn't that divert too much of our attention away from the principal danger? I want to say to all Americans this evening that whether it's a threat to the global environment or the erosion of America's leadership in the world, whether it is the challenge to our economy from new competitors or the challenge to our security from new enemies, I believe we need new leadership that is both strong and wise. And we can have new leadership. Because one of our greatest strengths as a democracy is that when we're headed in the wrong direction, we can correct our course. When policies are clearly not working, we, the people, can change them. If our leaders make mistakes, we can hold them accountable, even if they never admit their mistakes. I firmly believe America needs new leadership that will make us stronger at home and respected in the world, and we're here this week to present to the nation the man who should be and will be our new president, John Kerry. John and I were elected to the United States Senate on the same day 20 years ago, and I've worked closely with him for all that time. So I want to say a personal word about John Kerry, the man. He is a friend who will stand by you. His word is his bond. He has a deep patriotism that goes far beyond words. He has devoted his life to making America a better place for all of us. He showed uncommon heroism on the battlefield in Vietnam. I watched him show that same courage on the Senate floor. For example, he had the best record of protecting the environment against polluters of any of my colleagues, bar none. He never shied away from a fight, no matter how powerful the foe. He was never afraid to take on difficult and thankless issues that few others wanted to touch, like exposing the threat of narco-terrorism and tracing the sources of terrorist financing. He was one of the very first in our party to take on the issue of drastic deficit reduction, and he's developed a tough and thoughtful plan to restore our economic strength and fiscal discipline. To put it simply, those of us who have worked with John know that he has the courage, integrity, and leadership to be a truly great president of the United States of America. And he showed wisdom in his very first decision as the leader of our party when he picked as his running mate an inspiring fighter for middle-class families and families struggling to reach the middle class, John Edwards of North Carolina. John Kerry and John Edwards are fighting for us and for all Americans. So after we nominate them here in Boston and return back to our home states across this land, we have to fight for them. Talk to your
We're listening to Al Gore addressing the Democratic National Convention. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Volunteer your time and, above all, make your vote count. To those of you who felt disappointed or angry with the outcome in 2000, I want you to remember all of those feelings. But then I want you to do with them what I have done. Focus them fully and completely on putting John Kerry and John Edwards in the White House in 2004 so we can have a new direction in America. A new president, a new vice president, new policies, a new day, a brighter future, what this country and what our people deserve. Fellow Democrats, when I look out and see so many friends who have meant so much to me in my own public service, my heart is full tonight. I thank you for all the love you've shown to Tipper and me. You will forever be in our hearts. And there's someone else I'd like to thank. And that's the man who asked me to join
him. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Al Gore finishing up his remarks at the Democratic National Convention.
My friend and my partner for 8 years, President Bill Clinton. I will never forget that convention or that campaign, the way we barnstormed our country, carrying a message of hope and change, believing with our whole hearts that America could be made new again. And so it was. And with your help and with the leadership of John Kerry and John Edwards, so it shall be again. Thank you. God bless you. And may God bless the United States.
Former Vice President Al Gore, the Democrats' nominee in the year 2000, addressing the Democratic National Convention in the year 2004. And in full flow there, and Tipper coming back out on stage for one more kiss. We are listening in on speeches tonight and paying attention to the issues behind those speeches as we follow the Democratic National Convention live from Boston, where the delegates have gathered tonight for the first of four nights. On Thursday night, it will be John Kerry standing at that podium. I'm joined tonight by On Point senior news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, there's Al Gore. And no trouble finding his voice or the right tone and posture tonight, 4 years late, you might say.
You might say that. You know, it's hard to call a politician a tragic figure. They fall from fame to celebrity. But, and especially with what's happening in Iraq, the soldiers are the tragic figures in our play. But he is a cautionary tale, isn't he, for John Kerry? Because Al Gore, after losing the race, said that he sometimes all he could hear in his head was were the political consultants. He heard other men's voices in his head all the time, and he felt just estranged from himself and in a kind of cage. And it was only after the campaign was over that he showed, with a very gracious and witty concession speech, that he was the real person. And he certainly has found his voice as a tiger, a lion of Democratic wrath against Bush. So Kerry, as I say, a cautionary tale to John Kerry. Don't let those advisors talk you out of your selfhood.
Don't let them get you twisted up in your knickers.
That's
this
right.
Is not where you want to go. But Al Gore, looking hale and fit and in good form on a return trip to the Democratic National Convention. As he said, not the one he intended. We're going to be following all the events tonight and every night this week. We're also going to be looking at the issues behind what's going on the podium. Tonight we're looking at John Kerry on the issues. Beyond George Bush, where John Kerry would take this nation. You can join the conversation tonight. Where do you imagine a Kerry presidency taking U.S. policy on the economy, on social issues, on national security? We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And looking at the issues, I'm joined tonight right here with us on the rim of the Democratic National Convention's gathering in Boston by Roger Altman, John Kerry's chief economic advisor, a former Clinton deputy secretary of the Treasury. Delighted to have you with us tonight, Roger Altman. And joining us tonight from Brewster, Massachusetts, Bill Galston, an informal advisor to the Kerry campaign. He's professor of civic engagement at the University of Maryland, former deputy assistant to the president for domestic policy during the first Clinton administration. Good evening and welcome, Bill Galston.
Good to be here, Tom.
Wonderful to have you both. Roger Altman, let's go straight to this. Our time is short tonight. We want to get a sense of how you see the issues. John Kerry and the economy. We've seen what George Bush has done. He's come at it with tax cuts that he claims have stimulated the economy, and the economy is on something of an updraft right now. Talk to us about John Kerry, his likely economic policy. Where would he take the country?
Well, in essence, Senator Kerry has said that we should return to the basic policies which were pursued during most of the 90s, during the eight Clinton years, and which produced such unprecedented prosperity for this country, unprecedented rates of job creation, unprecedented rates of increase in family incomes and standard of living, and unprecedented gains, economically speaking, for all Americans, including business and investors. He's further said that President Bush has vacated almost every one of those five or six basic economic policies which this nation followed during the 90s. And that the central issue in this election, therefore, is whether we want to return to the policies which worked so well and so recently, whether we want to stay on this course, which Senator Kerry has often said, is a radical course. Now, those basic policies are really quite simple.
And take us to those, because, of course, the question is whether the 90s can be repeated. It was a pretty remarkable time. It ended up being seen as a time of great growth, but also the time of a bubble not likely to repeat itself anytime soon. What are the policies John Kerry would pursue, and could they really take us back to that kind of, you know, deep gravy?
Well, the policies are very simple. They're akin to many that American households follow. I don't think of them as Democratic policies versus Republican policies. I think of them as common sense policies, and they are. Number one, sound budgeting. Number two, a concentration from the point of view of tax policy on middle-income Americans, not the wealthiest. Number three, an emphasis finally on health care that can get done and that will bring most of the 44 million Americans who are today without health care coverage into the position where they have health care coverage. Stable American relations in the world community. An enlightened trade policy. And an active and cooperative working relationship with the business community. Those basic policies.
On the trade front, would John Kerry be as open as Bill Clinton, a famous campaigner for free trade zones? There's a lot of pressure on now to go the other way.
Well, Senator Kerry, number one, the analogy with Clinton is apt. Senator Kerry has a flawless voting record on trade. He voted for every piece of trade liberalizing legislation put before him in his 19 years in the Senate. He has stood behind all of the major recent trade agreements, not recanted his vote on any of those, from NAFTA to the WTO to the China agreement. He has talked, yes, a lot about enforcing those agreements and has argued that the Bush administration has been very lax on enforcing them. After all, they're contracts, and like any other contract, they should be enforced.
Enforcing labor regulations, environmental, and so on.
Yes, but he favors moving forward with further trade liberalization, provided that the types of labor and environmental standards that were encompassed, for example, in the recent Jordan agreement, or for that matter, in other proposals Senator Kerry has made, are actually present in those future agreements.
Bill Galston, to help us turn to social policy for a moment. We're not finished with economics. There's a lot to talk about there. But give us a sense of John Kerry on the big philosophical plane, first of all, on the social front. Would this too be Bill Clinton Redux, Bill Clinton in the form of John Kerry?
Well, I'd say that it's Clinton with a difference. John Kerry, like Bill Clinton, has chosen to put health care front and center. I think that was a very wise decision for all sorts of reasons, not the least of which, as Roger Altman has suggested, the huge impact that health care has on our economy, on the ability of businesses to hire new workers, which is one of the fundamental problems that we have today.
But, of course, Bill Clinton came in pretty early on health care and tripped him up very seriously.
Well, I've looked at the Kerry health policies pretty closely, and the campaign and the candidate seem to me to have learned important lessons from the difficulties that the Clinton health care plan encountered. It is the Kerry plan is considerably more market-oriented. It makes use of tax credits. It does not contemplate huge structural changes in the delivery of American medical care or medical insurance. And interestingly, it has in it a feature that would lift the burden of catastrophic health care costs off the backs of both businesses and employees. And I think that that is a very, very interesting and important proposal. So I think it's health care that, as Roger Altman has said, can happen. It is fiscally possible and politically possible. And
so when you say Bill Clinton, with a difference, you're pointing first to health care. What other differences in a Kerry administration, or is it back to the 90s, back to the Clinton
I don't think it's just back to the 90s. As the former Vice President Al Gore said in his speech, Senator Kerry is a very, very strong environmentalist. And frankly, I would expect not necessarily different environmental policies, but a somewhat higher profile for environmental policy than it enjoyed for much of the Clinton administration. Another way in which the Kerry social policy would be Clinton with a difference is in the area of education. Senator Kerry, I think, withstood a lot of pressure to retreat from the basic structure of the No Child Left Behind Act. And he said instead that his goal will be to redeem the promise of that act and also to do the things that are necessary to ensure that the promise of a high-quality teacher in every classroom can be redeemed. And he's put forward some extremely innovative proposals to achieve that objective.
So health care, strong environmental position, and bringing the resources to back the No Child Left Behind policy that, as you say, he's not backing away from, including the strong testing component there. Roger Altman, let me put it to you. Is there enough money in the kitty to fund the Kerry vision, or what does it take to make this thing balanced? Granted, it's not being balanced right now. Huge deficits coming, but the Republicans might say, well, if Kerry really wants to do all that, it's going to mean higher taxes and therefore a hit to the economy.
Well, first of all, I agree with Bill Galston's characterization. It's not just back to the 90s. And when I listed those common sense economic principles, those are timeless principles. Those are not 90s principles or 70s principles or 2010 principles, at least in my view. Second of all, yes, there are the resources to finance Senator Kerry's health care initiative and his education initiative and still to cut the deficit in half. And the reasons are twofold, if I can say. One is he has proposed to roll back the Bush tax cuts on the wealthiest Americans, those
right.
earning $200,000 a year or more, only people earning $200,000 a year or more. That happens to be 2% of taxpayers in this country, and that's the only people who'd be affected by that. Rolling them back to the levels that prevailed when President Clinton left office.
Okay.
Now, if you think about the condition of the economy we had in the mid-90s, late 90s.
The top 2% was doing pretty well.
And you ask yourself whether or not the tax rates we had in place at that time were thwarting the economy or impeding growth. Are harming family incomes, we know that they weren't. So returning to those tax rates in the context of overall better economic policies will not harm the economy. Indeed, it will help the economy as it did in the 1990s, only if it's part of an overall sensible strategy, not all by itself. Now, the revenues from rolling those tax rates back are more than enough to finance Senator Kerry's health care plan. We probably don't want to get all tied up in numbers, but they're about 25% more than necessary to do that. So, yes, there will be proper financing for that. The second reason that we can afford it is because Senator Kerry, and here's an area of big difference between Kerry and Bush,
difference. All right.
Kerry has said, let's return to the two basic budget rules that this country lived under during the 90s, first put in place by President Bush Sr., reenacted in 93 and then reenacted again in 97, all on a bipartisan basis. And those rules are very simple, and every household can identify with them. And they are pay as you go, mm-hmm. and then the system of caps, inflation-based caps, on non-defense discretionary spending backed up by an across-the-board cut, if need be. Those two rules were enacted in 1990 under the presidency of the first Mr. Bush. As I said, extended in 93, extended in 97. They elapsed in the early days of this administration, which was very happy to see them go. Senator Kerry has said, let's reinstate them by law, and let's, as a nation, live under them again. Mr. Bush has said, I don't want any part of that. I don't believe in those rules, and I don't want to, and he's been fighting hammer and tong against reinstating those. That's a big difference. Now, let me give you an illustration of why that's important. Over the 8 Clinton years, federal spending grew on average just a little over 3% a year, compound annual rate.
Right.
The Bush presidency so far, this is I'm citing the Wall Street Journal here,
mm-hmm.
8.2%, highest rate of spending increase over the past 10 presidents, And as I just said, almost three times higher than the rate of spending increase, just spending now, that we saw under President Clinton. Why?
Bush says 9/11 changed the world. He is acknowledging that, and if it costs something, it's the cost the country has to bear.
Well, I'm sorry. That's nice talk, but it happens to be wrong. If you take out Homeland Defense and you take out National Defense, spending has risen approximately 7% under President Bush versus 3% under President Clinton.
Then why?
They like to tell you things like that, but they're not true. Because we lived under these very basic budget rules, which every American household itself lives under during the 90s. And Mr. Bush happily buried them, doesn't want any part of them, and is fighting as aggressively as he can to be sure we don't go back to living under them. It's a very big difference between the two candidates.
Jack Beatty, come in here. It sounds like, hey, not just the 90s, not just Bill Clinton, but better. Brave new world here with John Kerry.
It does, and of course, critics have said there isn't enough money to do all this, and already Senator Kerry has had to tone down what I thought was one of the most promising of his programs, a commitment essentially to give a college education to kids who would give volunteer time back to the government. That struck me as something that would really connect with middle-class households. You know, it's who's against fiscal discipline and so on?
Well, Mr. Bush is.
Mr. Bush is. But, you know, when the Democrats run as the party of fiscal prudence, it limits the reach of their promises. It essentially says we're going to manage your money well, to the distressed, to the displaced, to people being put out of work by your trade policy, to people who need wage supplements, to inner city people who need investments. Well, all of this doesn't, it sounds a little bit like, well, great, and maybe your business cycle will give me a better job at Walmart, but...
Well, let's not ignore the recent lesson of history. During the 1990s, when we lived under the budget rules I'm talking about, every income category in this country, including our poorest citizens, saw substantial increases in their standards of living. And really, there's two basic obligations our government has. One is to protect our nation from the point of view of defense, and the other is to provide improved living conditions, improved standards of living for our citizens. During the 90s, we saw the second. For every category of income, from the lowest to the highest, and the best... To quote Hubert Humphrey, the best social program is a job, is a good-paying job. Now, in the 1990s, we created 23.5 million new jobs. Every single year we created, in those 8 years, there were 1 million-plus new jobs. Since Mr. Bush took office, the private sector has lost 2 million jobs. He'll be the first president since Herbert Hoover not to have created any net new jobs during his term. That's an astonishing record of ineptitude. So, to say... I say we need to live under the kind of fiscal sanity that every American household does. And when we did do that during the 90s, we saw unprecedented gains in standards of living for all Americans. So,
and do you really
think that it compromises the promise of the party? And I respect your point of view on that. But I would say it did not have that effect during the 90s. And if we follow these policies, it won't have that effect again.
And do you think, are you suggesting Americans can imagine 90s-style growth in this decade with all the new competitions that's out there, with the new burden of security requirements?
I don't know whether we can return to the precise growth and income gains of the 90s, because 2005, if Mr. Kerry's elected and when he takes office, will be different than the mid-90s. Lots of things have changed. Mm. However, I don't see any reason why we can't return to the very high levels of job creation we saw in the 90s. Senator Kerry's promised 10 million jobs over 4 years. I believe he'll exceed that. I don't see any reason we can't return to steadily rising standards of living in this country, real income gains. So whether we return to the precise levels of the 90s, I don't know. But will we get the great American job machine working again? Will we get standards of living rising again? Those are the key tests, and I believe Senator Kerry can pass them.
Roger Altman, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Roger Altman is John Kerry's chief economic advisor, was former Clinton Deputy Secretary of the Treasury. Bill Galston, please stick with us, and Jack Beatty as well. We are talking tonight about John Kerry on the issues. Beyond Bush, where would John Kerry take the nation? You can join the conversation. Is a vote for Kerry a vote for Clinton-style government or something else? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at John Kerry on the issues as we come to you live from the Democratic National Convention in Boston. Beyond George W. Bush, where would a John Kerry presidency take the nation? You can join our conversation tonight. What's the direction, the vision you see coming from a Kerry White House? Which way should this Democrat turn the wheel of state. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. We heard at the top of this hour from Al Gore. We will be hearing pretty soon, we're told, from Jimmy Carter. I want to turn first tonight in this segment to WBUR reporter Artie Cornish, who's been on the floor of the convention center. Artie Cornish, what did you make of the response to Al Gore returning here in 2004 after his failure in 2000?
Well, talking to a couple of delegates right away, people were saying that he really lit up the crowd. It was forceful, it was solid, and they were also saying that, frankly, it was better than he was 4 years ago. So a very good response, and they felt that he was solidly behind the candidates of today, Kerry and Edwards, and that they appreciated hearing him come out and be fiery and not trying to forget what happened in 2000, but to be solidly moving forward.
Al Gore walking a careful line there, not really getting far away from John Kerry's dictate. We won't go negative this week, but only by cloaking his anger at the year 2000 in a lot of humor in his comments.
Yes, it was actually a pretty funny speech. He even sort of made light of the famed kiss between he and Tipper. She got a standing ovation. So he was having fun, laughing at himself, and I think people like Al Gore when he's laughing.
But a little bit of that snarl as well tonight, a little bit of the two-fisted thing. Artie, thanks very much for your report from the convention hall's floor.
Thank you.
Artie Cornish, WBUR reporter. We are going to be talking on Wednesday night of this week all about and only about Iraq. So we've not given that as much attention in this conversation tonight, but we do want to look at foreign policy. We've been talking already with Bill Galston, an informal advisor to the Kerry campaign and former deputy assistant to the president for domestic policy during the first Clinton administration, and we'll be hearing more from him. We're joined now live at the Convention Center in Boston by Ash Carter, advisor to the Kerry campaign. He helped draft the 2004 Democratic platform. He's former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy in the Clinton administration. He's now a professor of science and international affairs at Harvard University. Ash Carter, great to have you with us.
Good to be here, Tom.
We have very little time tonight and a lot of ground to cover. John Kerry on foreign policy. What we've heard is I will be a multinationalist. What do you see as the primary building blocks of a John Kerry foreign policy?
Well, the thing I found interesting in working on the platform is the way it reflected John Kerry's style, which is natural enough because he's the only person here tonight who might be the nominee. So he had a strong influence over the platform. It's detailed, it's specific, it's positive. It's not just criticism of President Bush. It's got a lot of meat in there. It covers weapons of mass destruction, covers terrorism, the problems of the overstretch of the military, which is something John Kerry can easily relate to because of his own military background. And yes, the issue you raised of dealing with our alliances and partnerships. You know, President Bush said that we didn't need a permission slip from anyone else. Well, we know we don't need a permission slip to defend ourselves, but that's entirely beside the point. What is not beside the point is that if we work well with others, we strengthen our security, we're better at protecting ourselves. That's one of the tools in our toolkit, and John Kerry can restore that kind of standing with our alliances and will get them to pitch in places like Iraq. So all that's covered in the platform.
Fundamental difference between now and the year 2000, 9/11, of course, and the whole new and newly deeply understood and felt threat of terrorism. Is multilateralism enough there? How would John Kerry go at it that George Bush asked?
No, it's not. And the platform says that we were right after 9/11 to go on the offensive to take the war to the terrorists. It has a better way of doing that, makes some suggestions about how we can improve that, but the offense is the right thing to do. It talks a lot about the defense, homeland security. We need to do better at that. On the question of preemption, that sensitive question, the platform doesn't say we don't preempt when we see threats that are imminent to us, but it does say, hey, we shouldn't let them get imminent. So we should be dealing with North Korea, Iran. And when you do preempt, you want to preempt not alone, but have others with you. And we have failed in that regard as well. So this is not a platform that says leave the problems to other people or that we need to work with other people for the sake of working with other people. It's much more hard-edged than that.
Bill Galston, you can hear the tenor in this foreign policy posture. You've begun to describe for us John Kerry's likely domestic social policy. What's your sense of this candidate and his sense of what government does, of this fundamental role of government? Bill Clinton in the 90s shifted the Democratic posture on that. Where does John Kerry stand?
I think that John Kerry is a problem solver. And he sees government as a way, not the only way, but an important way of solving the people's problems. He also sees quite correctly that government, like an individual, can't do too many things at once. And that's why he's chosen to focus his campaign's attention, and his president, I think, would choose to focus the country's attention on a handful of absolutely critical problems. And I think he's made it very clear that he intends to lead off with health care as the top domestic social priority, and will work very hard to achieve just as much as health care programs he can. So those two aspects of Kerry's philosophy, namely problem solving and focus, I think will be much in evidence.
Ash Carter, problem solving and focus sounds very pragmatic. George Bush puts a lot of stock in having a very broad, easily understood ideological position. Does John Kerry have an inspiring ideological position behind that problem-solving predilection?
Well, I think he is problem-solving and pragmatic. And I think it's been interesting to work with him to see how his mind works. He's somebody who's very easy to talk to about defense because he has such a broad knowledge of defense. He's been around it so long. He served. So it's natural that he has a mastery of these issues and takes a problem-solving point of view. I mean, I think that in him, ideology is tempered by realism and experience. That doesn't mean that you're not pursuing values, because values not only are things that Americans want to see projected around the world, but they are part of protecting us. For example, one of the things you have to do about terrorism is make sure that we're not the ones that are isolated on the world stage, that the terrorists are isolated. And one of the ways you do that is by speaking to people's hearts around the world. That's not only a good thing for Americans to do, but it's hard-headed in today's world as well. So he gets that, but fundamentally he strikes me as a realist and a pragmatist.
Ash Carter and Bill Galston, it's great talking with both of you. In just a few minutes, I see Jimmy Carter is going to be stepping to the podium in the convention hall, and he may well take us right to the end of the hour. Stick with us for a minute here, but if we don't get a chance to say a proper goodbye, we appreciate both of you being with us. Jack Beatty, here we're hearing the analysis of these two men who have paid a lot of attention to John Kerry and his policies, the pragmatic problem solver, the right fit for our time, the right fit for the country's challenges, the right political profile.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, problem solving is all very well, but ideology and big visions and Manichaean formulations about the world tend to sell better, or at least you think they do. Bush is going to try those. He hasn't solved any problems, that's for sure, as president. But, I take this up with Bill Galston. Bill, you pretty much were one of the inventors or implementers of the Clinton policy. What struck me about Bill Clinton and domestic policy was that this was his meat. He had a whole vision of this, an integrated stuff that started with trade and went right down to the ghetto, involved every aspect of this. He was part of that conversation for years. Not true of John Kerry.
Well, John Kerry has been part of a different conversation for years, and a national conversation. Bill Clinton was part of an extremely important conversation among the nation's governors, which he brought with him to the White House. John Kerry will bring a different but equally valuable perspective. But I'd add one other thing, and this really follows on a point you made some time ago, Jack, namely that the single value that Senator Kerry has articulated about government and the political community in general is the ideal of service. And I think the notion that citizenship matters, that being a member of a political community means giving something in return for getting something, that is very, very genuine, very, very fundamental. He's articulated it very clearly, forcefully, genuinely, and I hope very much that your prediction is wrong, and that is a portion of his domestic program that is very, very high up.
And we're told we're going to be hearing more about the theme of service this week. Our callers have been patiently waiting. I'd like to turn to at least one right now. Bill is calling from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Great to have you, Bill. What's on your mind?
I live in Fayetteville, North Carolina, home of the 82nd Airborne.
Okay.
And there's been a whole lot of excitement about the John Kerry, John Edwards ticket. As you know, over the years, North Carolina has mostly won Republican. But now there's an excitement that everyone is excited about. I have one neighbor next door to me is a longtime Republican. And regardless of the situation in America, she's going to vote Republican. And I asked her, I said, could you name for me three things, three good things for the people in America, not overseas, not in other lands, that he has done good for the people in America? And the only answer that she can give me is that the tax breaks. Well, if you don't have a job, you don't get a tax break.
We've got it, Bill. So what does John Kerry need to say? Or is he saying it? Has he got it wrapped up in your neighborhood? Is he going to get her vote?
She needs a little more persuading. But what she needs to hear is that Kerry's going to do things like, even though jobs are going to go overseas, we're not going to subsidize and pay taxes for the people to take the jobs and our tax money. He needs to let them know that Bush is destroying our future because the deficits are going to be so high that we're not going to be able to. I'm 45 years old, and there's not going to be any Social Security probably with the deficits as high as they are. I enjoy things like I have two kids that are in college. Help with my college tuition for my children is a great hope and benefit for me. These are things that are going to help the young guy, the little guy, the not-so-wealthy guy that she's not quite understanding. She looks at a car and she sees a large-sized trunk, but she doesn't see that the car is not the color that she likes. It's the standard. She only looks at the truck. And because
Bill, we've got it, and our time is running short, but you're making a case here in the reading between the lines, Ash Carter. I hear a supporter of John Kerry who's saying, John, why aren't you stronger, more specific, more pointed in your criticisms or in your explanation of what you're going to do?
Well, I think in the area of defense, people don't want criticism. They look around. They see things are problematic in Iraq. They see that terrorism is an ever-present danger. And they don't need to be told that these are a problem. They don't need to be told, really, that we're not managing them very well. They see that. They want to know, what is John Kerry going to do different that's better? That's what's laid out in the platform. I think that's what he said in his speeches. So that's what they want to hear. What are you going to do that's going to make us safer? And that's where he is someone who has the experience and the ideas that I think are pretty persuasive.
And Bill Galston, if that's the case, why isn't John Kerry coming across with the same clarity that Bill Clinton did in 92 and 96? Is it just he's got a different style, or does he have a less fully formed vision for his domestic program?
No, I think it's a kind of an optical illusion. We forget how much Bill Clinton was struggling politically all through the spring and early summer. 1992,
sure
John Kerry is actually in a considerably stronger position at this point than Bill Clinton was. Clinton's candidacy didn't really take off until after the convention. It has been said a number of times, and I think it's true, that it has been a very long time since a challenger to an incumbent president has been in such a strong position going into his own convention. And that suggests to me that the Kerry campaign has made a lot of headway already in overcoming people's doubts. It is also the case that a very high percentage of the people still say that they don't know very much about him. Well, John Kerry is going to get a chance to change that starting on Thursday.
And starting tonight through surrogates who are mounting the podium even as we speak. Bill Galston, it's been great having you this evening. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Bill Galston, an informal advisor to the Kerry campaign, professor of civic management at the University of Maryland, and Ash Carter, professor of science and international affairs at Harvard University, advisor to the Kerry campaign. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Good to be here.
We're going to have Jimmy Carter in just a moment, but I think that's going to come in the next segment. Jack Beatty, great to have you on your mind as we wrap up our first evening.
Well, yes, there was one candidate who was doing very well at the time of his convention, Michael Dukakis. He was 17 points ahead.
Ah, me. And that was not such a successful run after all. And we notice he's not on the speaker's lineup tonight either. Well, but he made his run. Much more to come throughout this week as we come to you live from the Democratic National Convention. Jimmy Carter's coming up next. You'll see the whole lineup this week. It's been great having you all tonight. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.